From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Joining me today is Ian Davis. Ian is an independent journalist, writer, and researcher whose work can be found at iandavis.com. Ian spelled with two I's, I-A-I-N. You can also find his writing at iandavis.substack.com, as well as at ukcolumn.org, offguardian.org, unlimitedhangout.com, and geopoliticsandempire.com, which is helmed by my TNT colleague, Hrvoje Moric. Ian, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well, Jesse. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Absolutely. So we're almost 2 weeks into a banking crisis that started in the U.S. with Silicon Valley Bank and has since become global, extending to much larger institutions like Credit Suisse. And there is almost certainly more contagion, as it's put, on the way. So much is happening so quickly that already it's been easy, at least for me, to lose sight of where this started with SVB and how it started, what was behind the collapse of SVB, and what continues to drive the so-called contagion. And you detailed this at some length in a recent piece for Geopolitics and Empire titled, "Was the Collapse of SVB Deliberately Orchestrated?" It's an excellent forensic analysis of what happened, and I want to get into that in detail. But before we do, what's your answer to that question at this point? You published this late last week. We're working on it for some time before then. Have you come to a more conclusive answer to that question at this time, or is it still up in the air or anyone's guess to you? And does it even matter at this point if it was deliberately orchestrated or not?
Thanks, Jesse. I'm glad we've had an opportunity to talk about this, because this is incredibly important, as is the subject of central bank digital currency. And it's not getting the exposure I think that it should be getting. My view on it now has changed somewhat. I mean, all the actions that led to the collapse of the SVB bank were Silicon Valley Bank, were deliberate policy decisions. There's no doubt about that. And the actions of the venture capitalist fund, the founders fund led by Peter Thiel, that was a deliberate decision. So there's no doubt that it was deliberate in that sense. Was the intention the question is then, was the intention to cause a collapse and a wider contagion? And I think now, I just kind of left it to the readers to just look at the evidence and make up your own mind. I think people have got to apply a little bit of common sense to this and see if the evidence suggests that possibility. And I suggested in the article that it did. But subsequent events, I think, make that harder to deny than to, not. Because we've just seen things were moving incredibly quickly. I mean, at the time of the SVB collapse, it just so happened that Jerome Powell was speaking to a Financial Select Committee a Senate Hearing Committee on Finance, and announced, in discussions that the Fed had already decided that it had a kind of wholesale CBDC idea lined up. And when asked, if this would require congressional approval. He said no. He said no, we can roll this out without congressional approval. I mean, you know, obviously the Federal Reserve is supposed to be the U.S. central bank, but these are all private banks. These are all private institutions. You know, we can see from the comments of previous people like Bernanke and Greenbaum and people like that, that the Fed considers itself to be independent of the state, really, of the government, I should say. And really, it doesn't really have any recourse to government, even though it supposedly does. But I mean, in saying that, they can go ahead and set up a wholesale CBDC, which would be the replacement for what we might call Federal Reserve or Reserve Central Reserve money, which is some people might call base money. You know, they're more or less, they announced that on the, or rather Powell said that on the 9th of March, which was the day that SVB went belly up. Subsequently, we've now just had the release of the president's economic report. And in that economic report, it's outstanding, the narrative that they are creating. And I have to say that reading some of the quotes from that economic report, this has been lifted more or less word for word from identical documents that have come from the Bank for International Settlements. I mean, some of the phrases are identical. So I think that's important to bear in mind as well. But you know, that in part of that financial report, he kind of very much kind of, or rather, you know, the Treasury, really, let's be honest, the US Treasury very much downplayed the potential benefits of cryptocurrencies. And when I'm talking about cryptocurrencies, obviously, I mean the independent private cryptocurrencies, things like Bitcoin and Ethereum and so forth like that, saying they're decentralized. Yeah, decentralized cryptocurrencies, saying that they're destabilizing and basically just assets that people speculate on and not much more. And there is some truth to that. That's fair enough. You know, but then we looked at, because it wasn't just SVB Bank. There was, what was it, Silver? Oh, I've forgotten the name of the bank.
Silvergate
and another bank as well.
Signature,
that's right, that were in basically investing in crypto. So they went down as well. And there's this comment that comes up in the presidential's financial report. And it says, fortunately, there has not yet been a systemic crisis caused by crypto assets, in part because they are not fully integrated with the rest of the financial system, giving policymakers time to act appropriately. So at the same time, the Fed have announced this thing called this settlement platform called FedNow. So right. FedNow is going to go live in July. And what the idea of FedNow is that it's going to be a settlement system, and it will be an integral part of the financial system. And the idea is that it will promote the benefits of central bank digital currency, in effect, over the decentralized counterparts, using this very spookily useful system for the interoperability of central bank digital currencies. Because if central bank digital currencies are going to work, then they need to be able to be exchanged with each other in a reasonable and fast settlement system, which it looks very much like FedNow is preparing the basis for doing that, coupled with the announcement that they can launch wholesale CBDC without congressional approval. This is all moving very quickly. And in the actual report from the president or the president's office, this is what it said about CBDC. And this is a quote. It would have the potential to offer significant benefits. It could enable a payment system that is more efficient, provide a foundation for further technological innovation, facilitate faster cross-border transactions, and be environmentally sustainable. It could also promote financial inclusion and equity by enabling access to a broad range of consumers. And then they warned, in addition, because central bank is the safest form of money, A widely accessible CBDC would be particularly attractive to risk-averse users, especially during times of stress in the financial system. So
that's almost exactly what the BIS has been putting out in its literature.
Yeah. I haven't checked the direct quote, but I've looked at a lot of these BIS documents as well. And that strikes me as being practically word for word, same as in the BIS risk analysis report, which is one of the things that I cited in the article. Because one of the things that they're saying about CBDC, now the same is said in the US presidential report, and the same is said by the BIS, is that they make this argument that because it's a safe haven, because it's a direct liability of the central bank, that people might run to it in a financial crisis. And this could precipitate more financial, more runs on banks, on commercial banks. But of course, you can flip that on its head. That equally means that if you want to encourage uptake of central bank digital currency, because that comment is probably right, that is probably accurate, people probably would run to it in a collapse, then if you precipitate a financial collapse, and it is clear that the monetary policy of the Federal Reserve precipitated the financial collapse of SVB and other banks, which has now spread internationally, then you are creating the conditions for the uptake of central bank digital currency. I think that is that is absolutely clear. That is clear from their documentation.
Yes, absolutely. And you make that argument in your piece for Geopolitics and Empire. And I think that the former argument is there to provide cover for the latter argument, which is what this is all about. But either way, it's a win for central bank digital currency. And we're already seeing moves toward centralization as opposed to toward decentralization. So people have flocked to institutions like Bank of America, for example, to store their deposits there. And it's a short step from a rush to huge institutions like Bank of America to central bank digital currency. And the rush of depositors is trending in that direction very quickly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's centralizing, centralizing the financial system. That's what it's doing. I mean, that's the, as highlighted by the BIS and by the presidential report, that's the effect of such precipitous financial collapse. But I mean, one of the things that is really interesting is people may run to the larger banks, thinking that they're safer, but actually the larger banks have got bigger exposure to the kind of risks that caused the collapse of SVB. For example, the reason that SVB collapsed was that it was holding a large amount of US treasuries and a large amount of investments in things like mortgage securities and things like mortgage backed securities. In what it called its HTM portfolio, its held till maturity portfolio. So these were long-term investments and securities that were purchased when interest rates were near zero. They were gambling and betting that the Fed wouldn't raise interest rates significantly. Well, not only did the Fed raise interest rates significantly, which devalues the market price of those securities. Not only did the Fed raise it more than they expected, the Fed raised it incredibly quickly. I mean, the Fed has raised it to 5% in a year, which has absolutely blown those investments to pieces. Now, one of the interesting things is that when the first story first broke, everyone was talking about SVB being exposed to mortgage-backed securities primarily, but that isn't what they were. That isn't the largest share of their certainly of their HTM portfolio. This was government bonds,
right?
So the Fed has holed out government bonds, U.S. Treasuries. This is the
which basis. are supposed to be the most secure assets.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the basis of, really the US economy and how the money markets work. I mean, it's incredible, really, when we think about what's happened. But what has also been exposed, and I remember seeing John Titus talk about this, I think nearly 2 months ago now. John Titus mm-hmm. was talking about this huge exposure at the heart of the US banking system. Now, he more or less totally, contrary to all the other quote unquote experts, financial experts around the world, he more or less 100% accurately predicted what would happen if, because of this exposure to what are called unrealized losses. So these unrealized losses on securities are the difference between the market price of those assets and securities, including treasuries, when they were purchased some time ago by banks like SVB and JP Morgan and other big banks like that. JP Morgan is sitting on 50 billion of these unrealized assets, unrealized losses, and their current market price. So across the US banking sector, currently, those unrealized losses are standing at something like $625 billion or more. Mm-hmm. Now, that's at the end of December. So this is going to be much worse now. It'd probably be closer to something like, $800-900 billion.
Right.
That's across the US banking system. But that shortfall, that if you look at the what the FDIC are putting out as the total amount of assets that the US banking system holds, so that's the Federal Deposit and Insurance Corporation that allegedly insure these losses, potential losses, you could apply the same effective haircut to the largest amount of those alleged assets, which is the 12.2 trillion in loans and leases that the banks, the US banks, have in total on their books. Now, if there's a similar level, because those loans and leases would have been made when interest rates were very low, if there's a similar amount of losses, let's say it's around 10%, which is what the $625 billion represents on the unrealized losses, then you're looking at something like $1.4 trillion black hole in the middle of the US banking system's alleged assets.
Mm-hmm.
So if you add it all together, we're getting up to $2 trillion. Now, that's looking a lot to me. And I mean, I followed what John Titus recommended, and I had a look at the FDIC's, what they call it, its composite balance sheet, which shows everything that's on the US banking, across the entire banking system, what its assets and liabilities are. So we're looking at an absolutely enormous black hole in the middle of. And nobody seems to be talking about this. Everybody's just going on about, I'll notice people are talking about the unrealized losses that are on the treasuries and the MBS securities. But you can apply a similar discount to all its other assets.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at, basically, it's not unreasonable to say that the US banking system is insolvent. It's gone.
It's kaput.
So, yeah, yeah. And I mean, we've known this for a long time. I mean, people like you and I have been talking about this for a long, long time. But I mean, but John, what John Titus has done has just pointed out, look, there's the evidence. And you look at it, and the numbers don't add. Well, the numbers do add up. What they add up to is bankruptcy. That's what they add up to.
Right. And you link to that video. It's John Titus's latest video in your piece, and I highly recommend people watch that. It is almost uncanny how he points that out and predicts it months in advance. But I would say that's because he's a brilliant guy when it comes to monetary policy. And he saw what was coming, and he's been screaming, not literally, but screaming about this for quite some time, as have other people. But even now, as you said, with what's happened over the last almost 2 weeks, not much attention is being paid to this black hole. And just to summarize what you said, I want to read from your piece for Geopolitics and Empire. The $625 billion potential loss represents a 10.6% discount on the nominal market price of $5.9 trillion in securities that the FDIC claims as a banking system asset. This reflects the damage caused by the Fed's reckless, and reckless is in inverted commas, monetary policy switch. Similarly, when the commercial banks made their loans and leases, they would have overwhelmingly done so at the pre-inflation interest rate. Therefore, it is not unreasonable to apply the same 10.6% discount to the value of the claimed $12.2 trillion loans and leases asset. This represents a further $1.3 trillion in potential losses across the U.S. banking system. We could also apply a similar discount to the $5.2 trillion in all other assets. Further analysis would be required to accurately calculate it. Suffice to say, this is an additional unknown loss. You then go on to write, if we add the $625 billion in possible securities losses to the likely $1.3 trillion shortfall in loans and leases assets, it appears the U.S. banking system actually holds something closer to $21.7 trillion in assets. With $23.6 trillion in liabilities, U.S. banks are seemingly in the hole for $1.9 trillion. The FDIC also asserts that there is approximately $2.2 trillion in total equity capital held by the beneficial owners of the commercial banks. This explains why, even with near equal total assets and liabilities on the composite balance sheets, which there isn't near equal total assets and liabilities on the composite balance sheets, as you pointed out. But this explains why, with this illusion, the FDIC can maintain and the Fed can maintain and Janet Yellen can maintain that the U.S. banking system is fine. So I wanted to read that to summarize what you just laid out to underscore those huge numbers and the fact that we're talking about numbers that represent collapse, no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, what seems to be going on at the moment is a cover-up. They're pointing at the unrealized losses, which are the losses that they've made on the securities and the treasuries and the mortgage-backed securities, because that is, it is something that is containable. You know, you could argue that that's containable. That's similar. You know, 625 is similar to the 700 billion that that they bailed the banks out before. During the 2008 financial crisis. So you could sort of see that people would be kind of willing to consider that this might be possible to maintain the banking system. You can't cover 2 trillion. They can't cover 2 trillion. Now, they're not talking about that, but they are talking about shoring up financial stability using things like, you know, the recently announced the Fed. I've forgotten the name, it's gone out of my head. But I mean, you know, they could kind of make up that the whole situation is recoverable and that you know, there's nothing to worry about, don't worry, don't panic. But what they must know, surely they must know, is that it isn't recoverable. It's not remotely recoverable. The game is up. The whole system is, I mean, and I think another important thing to bear in mind is if, because people perhaps sitting in France and Germany, and certainly in France at the moment, they might feel they've got more to worry about than what's going on in the US financial system. It's difficult to put that together. People don't seem to realize quite what the meaning of this is for us all around the world. I mean, I'm in the UK. Mm-hmm. Currently, there's something like the BIS estimate that something like 60% of all global assets are denominated in dollars. Now, if the US financial system goes down and the dollar collapses, the impact of that on every single country around the world will be tectonic. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, it's so important, I think, that people grasp this. Now, if it does go down, and it must surely now. I mean, we are very, very close to the final meltdown. Then it seems pretty obvious that will be the rationale. The rescue package has already been set up, and it is central bank digital currency.
Yes,
I think. I mean, Powell said that they're years away from bringing in central bank digital currency. I don't believe that. Not for a moment.
I don't either.
I mean, it's already been rolled out. There are 114 central banks around the world and governments, you could argue, but let's just say central banks around the world who are currently developing CBDC. 11 have already gone live. They've already gone live in Nigeria. Now, if you go to the Atlantic Council CBDC tracker, they say that China hasn't gone fully live yet. It's still in development. But it has, of course. I mean, if you take numbers of people, China's CBDC is already serving something like 200 million people, which is more than any other country in the world. So effectively, China's digital yuan or e-yuan or ECNY has gone live. So to say that the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England aren't ready yet is just implausible. When other countries have already established theirs, of course theirs is ready. It's all ready.
Right.
And they're setting up the system now for the tectonic shock. And let's not forget that when they pull the trigger on this, when they say, oh yeah, the whole system's bankrupt, sorry about that. When they do that, that will have a real impact on people's lives. People will go out of business. People will starve. It will have a real physical impact on people across the world. But they don't care about that. They just want to bring in central bank digital currency.
Right. And what have been the losses people have absorbed already or sustained already? Who knows? With Credit Suisse, for example, and it's first there was the injection by the Swiss National Bank of about $50 billion. That wasn't enough. Then UBS stepped in, and in UBS stepping in, there was $17 billion in bonds that were vaporized in a day, in less than a day. Whose money was that? How many people did that affect? What's going to happen to those people? Who knows? Because it's not being reported on, but that's a huge amount of money that was just entirely erased with a keystroke or what have you. And this is not isolated to Credit Suisse. This, again, it started with SVB, but if we can get into the crypto part of this for a bit, I think it started with FTX. I would go back to FTX. Yeah. But before we do that, in terms of central bank digital currency, Russia is also ready to go with this. So Rossiyskaya Gazeta is a Russian language media outlet. RG.ru is the address you can find it at. They published a piece on the 7th of this month titled "The Law on the Digital Ruble Will Be Adopted by the End of March." So just to read from a few excerpts from this piece, "The law on the digital ruble will be adopted in all three readings by the end of March," Anatoly Aksakov, head of the State Duma Committee on the Financial Market, told Rossiyskaya Gazeta, quote, "The bill will be finalized by the second reading. We will receive the government's comments. Nothing critical, technical details. Otherwise, we would not have adopted it so quickly. We decided to act faster. In mid-March, we will submit it to the State Duma for consideration," unquote. "The amendments define the legal regime and rules for the use of the digital ruble, including the rules for the circulation of digital rubles in Russia. According to the proposals, the digital ruble becomes a non-cash money, the currency of the country, and the central bank is responsible for the safety of the digital rubles. The State Duma Committee also approved accompanying amendments to the Civil Code, which introduced provisions on a digital wallet and a digital account. The same draft defines the procedure for making payments in digital rubles." So, like China, like the US, like the EU, as Lagarde's recent statements made clear, if they're to be believed, Russia is ready to go with this. This is a global operation. There's global cooperation. There's no escape from it. And it makes sense that the Fed, as powerful as it is, even though what technically backstops it is fake money, it makes sense that the Fed, as powerful as it is, would be leading the charge for this. And that's what we're seeing. There's no argument about it in my mind.
No, absolutely. I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, one of the interesting things about Russia is Russia, I think it launched its amended its legal code for the law on digital tokenized assets, or what it was calling digital assets. Putin announced that, I think, in 2019 or 2020. And this creates I think it's very important with central bank digital currency to consider the idea of interoperability. So interoperability, yes, will enable central bank digital currencies, national central bank digital currencies, to be exchanged in real time without any kind of lengthy, exchange rate mechanisms or anything like that. So you will literally be able to purchase goods from another country in your CBDC, and it will instantly make payment in that country's CBDC. So that's the idea of interoperability. That's what the BIS innovation hubs have been working with relentlessly over the last few years to ensure that whatever CBDC nation states put out, whether it's the digital ruble or the digital pound, they will be interoperable. So you can exchange goods. Now, Russia's law on digital assets, what that means is that everything can be tokenized. So, for example, gold can be tokenized. So what this means is that there can also be distributed ledger technology such as a blockchain, maybe not necessarily so, but everything can have a digital asset assigned to it. So you could buy, for example, shares in a gold bar. There could be so many gold tokens that are, you know, supposedly shares in a gold bar. Now, Sberbank, which is Russia's biggest quote-unquote state-owned but really commercial bank, has already launched its digital gold-backed token. So what they can argue, and what I'm sure that they will argue, is that by linking this together with, for example, Russia's Russian ruble, so the Russian ruble might be a digital token-backed gold currency, which sounds suspiciously like a shell game to me, because I think that's what it is. This is adding further stability, financial stability, to central bank digital currency. We've already seen
actual collateral for it.
Yeah. So we've already seen, of course, it isn't. It's a digital token which can be subdivided or multiplied, or it is a shell game. We've already seen Iran and I think it might have been China, or was it Russia? It might have been Iran and Russia moot the possibility of a gold-backed stable coin for cross-border settlements. So this has been building up to this point consistently in every country in the world. Russia and China are no exception. China's been leading on this, really. I mean, China's way out in front. Nigeria has, you know, perhaps the biggest population-wise country to launch a full central bank digital currency. But all nations are doing this. They're all doing it. So the idea that it's not, you know, that we can avert it by perhaps appealing to governments. I mean, I noticed that there's the bill that Emery has put forward in the US to stop the CBDC Anti-Surveillance Act, which, you know, clearly some members of the political class are aware that this is essentially a system of control. It's a control system. But I mean, whether or not that bill will make it any further through the House, I think is highly unlikely. Everyone is on board with this. Everyone. And they all want it to come to fruition. And when it does, if CBDC, if we get lulled into using it, then, you know, it is literally, I mean, I've just written two posts on my Substack. Central bank digital currency is the end game. And it really is the end game.
Yes, because I highly recommend those two pieces as well to supplement the one we're talking about. Yes, it is the end game, and not just for the international monetary and financial system, but the end game emphasis on end for human freedom, inalienable human freedom.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, currently, if you want to impose a lockdown, I mean, look at the 15-minute cities thing that everybody's been talking about recently. So currently, in order to get people to stay within 15 minutes of their homes, you need to pass some sort of legislation. There needs to be a kind of regulatory framework that inhibits people from going outside of 15 minutes from their home, and they might ignore that. They might decide, oh, I can't be bothered with that. I'm going to do whatever I want. With CBDC, you just ensure that their money doesn't work more than 15 minutes from their home. It's as simple as that.
Right.
It's programmable money. So that, and who will it be programmed by? It will be programmed by the central banks and the banks for international settlements, not governments. They want you to think that it will be programmed by governments. It's not going to be programmed by governments. It's going to be programmed by central banks.
No, the government is there to rubber stamp it, to enforce the policies that are handed down to it from above, as you and I have talked about times. And as you've made clear in your excellent chart that shows the hierarchy of the global public-private partnership, the government is way toward the bottom of that hierarchy and is a policy enforcer. Policies are distributed to it. it enforces those policies. That's its role. It doesn't really come up with policies, despite what the story we're told ad nauseum. It's a rubber stamper. That's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, we can see that. I mean, if we look at, you know, what happened during the pseudo pandemic, everybody's talking about Build Back Better, which is obviously a short, you know, everyone, you know, Biden, Johnson, Macron, Putin. Well, maybe not Putin, not Build Back Better, but certainly rebuilding after the disaster. You know, they're all using the same kind of language, which is what? Which is Great Reset, isn't it? So that policy, mm-hmm. that policy agenda, they don't all start speaking with the same voice. They go to things like the Munich Security Conference, where people like, you know, Adhanom Ghebreyesus tell them what public health preparedness policies they're going to pursue. You know, right. this is set at a world governance level. Now, what they come up with is policy agenda, and it's then the individual nation states' responsibility to put that into some sort of policy framework. Now, the Bank for International Settlements have been going on about central bank digital currency for a long time. They've been pushing it. All central banks around the world are pushing it. And that's not an accident. That isn't, you know, it's not, they're not doing it because suddenly there's a pressing need to have a CBDC. There is from their perspective, because of the threat that decentralized things like decentralized cryptocurrency potentially threatens their financial, international monetary and financial system. So they need a solution. Right. CBDC is it. So
I think to add to that too, what has undergirded the international monetary and financial system for so long now is completely untenable, as you've laid out in your piece for GME. We're not talking about real money. We're not talking about real value. We're not even talking about a real economy in a lot of this. There's nothing there. It's worthless. And the Fed can finagle with interest rates, as it did just this afternoon, coming from the Wall Street Journal at about 2 p.m. Eastern today. The Fed raised the rates by a quarter point. And according to the Wall Street Journal, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates for a ninth consecutive time to fight inflation, but it signaled banking system turmoil might end its rate rise campaign sooner than seemed likely 2 weeks ago. So all of this can be done, but as I've said before, it's like putting a finger over a cut throat to stop the bleeding. It looks like it might do something, but it's not going to do piss.
No. And it's interesting that in raising those rates, and those rates have risen subsequent to me writing this the article for Geopolitics and Empire, they've just made that situation worse. They've just increased the losses by raising those rates further.
Right.
So they're screwing their own economy while saying they are rescuing it.
Right. And this goes back to the bonds, the treasuries, and the mortgage-backed securities that are at the heart of this. Every time the rates go up, those securities, those treasuries, they lose value. And the Fed knows this. And yeah, also the institutions investing in these treasuries and securities, they know it too. But they've been told by the Fed that this is the proper way to go. You take the deposits that come in, the cash that comes in, and you invest it in these long-term, low volatility treasuries and securities. This has been on the books since 2008, at least. And that's exactly what SVB did. And then, as you pointed out, the Fed's deliberate policy choices torpedoed that. And there's no other way for this to work now. It's finished. There's essentially no safe haven from what's happening. despite what the Global Times, which is a Chinese state media outlet, published yesterday that international capitals are likely to seek, quote, safe haven, unquote, in China amid Western bank crisis. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Chinese banks have huge exposure to the problem we're talking about right now.
Well, China's the biggest country and it's got, holds more U.S. treasuries than any country in the world. So I'm not quite sure. You know, but you know, I think the point here is that at the bottom of this, the problem is that the U.S. is currently spending around 26% of its tax take just servicing its debt. So there is that fundamental problem. It's reaching its borrowing limit. Just servicing the interest on its debt. Yeah. So it can't carry on doing what it's doing. But debt to GDP ratios in other countries around the world, such as Russia and China, is much lower. It's, mm-hmm. you know, 20%. It's 20%. That's its total debt to GDP ratio. In the US, it's 100+%. In the UK, it's 100+%. So now I think Catherine Austin Fitz has spoken about this, and she's quite right. This, what we're looking at, as we looked at with the war in Ukraine, is this: the war in Ukraine is serving as a pivot, as a realignment of the global financial and monetary system. Now, it's like a good analogy, and I think Catherine Austin Fitz has used this, is the scorpion jumping from its dead frog onto a live frog, mm-hmm. right? So in Russia and in the East more broadly, so in the East and in these emerging markets, the debt problem isn't so severe. Now, as you quite rightly say, China is massively exposed to US treasuries. So it does have a problem there, but it can wear it because it can probably absorb that better than most because of the debt to GDP ratio. So this is what we're seeing, is a realignment of markets where these new emerging markets will be what George Soros said many years ago. China will be the engine of the world. Now, it will be that in terms of its productivity, but also in terms of the new financial system that is emerging. So this is what's happening. This is the transition that we are being taken through. So Western economy is set for decline. Undoubtedly, it is undoubtedly set for significant decline. There's going to be a rebalancing of economies. Investment is going to increase in the East. You know, that we're looking at Eurasia, investment will increase, and that will rebalance global power as well. We're seeing it militarily as well. So this is going to be a rebalancing of global power, and that is going to deliver what people are calling the multipolar world order.
Right. And within that rebalancing, we should have no illusions that those who come out on top, so to speak, of the rebalancing are going to be the good guys or are going to operate any differently than what we've seen in the so-called unipolar order. You and I have gone through a litany of evidence that, to me, proves that that will be the case. We'll see business as usual to an extent, although it won't be as usual with CBDC in the mix and very likely severe social control measures related to use of CBDC. So again, we should be under no illusions that this shift is going to bring in some sort of good guy contingent to replace US hegemony. We only have a few minutes, but I really quickly want to touch on the cryptocurrency part of this, because I think that is central to, well, one of the central components to bringing in CBDC is tarnishing and doing away with particularly decentralized cryptocurrency. And I think this started with the collapse of FTX. And if you go back to the BIS's bulletin number 66 from the 12th of January of this year, in the very beginning of it, it has, and it's titled Addressing the Risks in Crypto, Laying Out the Options. It has key takeaways, and it says the recent high-profile failures of FTX and other crypto firms have reignited the debate on the appropriate policy response to address the risks in crypto, including through regulation. The shadow financial functions enabled by crypto markets share many of the vulnerabilities of traditional finance. These risks are exacerbated by specific features of crypto. Authorities may consider different, not mutually exclusive, lines of action to tackle the risks in crypto. These include containment or regulation of the crypto sector or an outright ban. Central banks and public authorities should also work to make TradFi, traditional finance, more attractive. A key option is to encourage sound innovation with central bank digital currencies, CBDCs. And then the Financial Stability Board on the 16th of February issued a report, The Financial Stability Risks of Decentralized Finance, which is much along the same lines of what the BIS stated in that bulletin. So we see this concerted effort coming from the top financial institutions, the central bank for central banks, for example, to not contain decentralized crypto, but to, or not to ban it, but to do away with it completely and replace it with CBDC. So your final words in wrapping up.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, if CBDC is going to take, then cash and cryptocurrencies have got to go. So they're creating the regulatory environment to ensure that it does. Russia's way ahead on that. That's what its digital law on digital assets was all about. And also, I mean, the important thing to remember is one of the things that they say about CBDC, why it won't work, is that it's a threat to commercial banks. And that is why the UK digital pound and the Russian digital ruble are based upon a platform model which will incorporate and include the big commercial banks. They will be acting as the payment gateways for CBDC. So they're incorporating the commercial banks into the model so that they don't throw their toys out of the pram and destabilize CBDC.
Ian, thank you, sir. Until next time.